Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for coming along. We are going to start this hour by meeting somebody who's affected by President Trump's new ban on transgender people in the military. Trump has told the Pentagon to stop admitting new transgender service members and decide how to treat people who are already serving. Here at Joint Base, Lewis McCord, Army Staff Sergeant and Bronze Star recipient Patricia King, was the first U.S. infantryman to come out as transgender. Welcome, Sergeant.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Before I ask you about President Trump's new policy, how did you earn the Bronze Star in Afghanistan?
I was awarded a Bronze Star for service at the end of my last deployment in 2014 after a year of serving as a platoon sergeant and eventually platoon leader and bringing my platoon back safe.
Was there anything in particular that got the committee's attention that for which they decorated you?
I served as a PSD platoon sergeant, which means it was my job to escort dignitaries up to and including the Secretary of Defense as they traveled around southern Afghanistan.
What did you think when you first heard that President Trump was banning transgender people from the military?
My first thought was that I was really shocked because we're talking about questioning my readiness when I am qualified and able to deploy right now. So we're talking about banning a group of people, and we've used such excuses as the cost, which we've already discussed and negated based on things like the RAND Corporation survey. And now we're talking about readiness when we've seen through our 18 partner nations, as well as service members who are deployed to Afghanistan right now, the readiness simply isn't an issue for transgender service members.
Yeah, I want to talk about the idea of readiness. The Trump administration has said that allowing people who are transgender to openly serve is bad for unit cohesion and military readiness. And I, a civilian, have some guess as to what that means, like soldiers won't work together because some of them will be offended or gender identity is going to overshadow military identity. Is that the concern?
I think that is possibly the concern. However, I have a hard time understanding this. First of all, as a person who has been serving openly transgender in the military for the last 2 years, I simply haven't encountered that, nor have I met a trans service member who has said that people flat out will not work with them. We've seen throughout our nation's history that sometimes bringing groups of people together can be turbulent and confusing in the beginning. When we had desegregation, it was difficult at first, and people made many of the same claims. And then it turned out that it wasn't an issue. I remember that that General Milley has been quoted as saying that the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the biggest non-event of his entire career, because people were very concerned, and there was a lot of buildup. Oh, my goodness, when we allow openly gay people to serve, it's going to affect unit cohesion. And then they looked at it a year afterwards, and what they realized is that there was no effect on cohesion, there was no effect on readiness, and open transgender service is the same as it applies to cohesion.
President Trump has given his defense secretary 6 months to develop the new transgender ban. Has it already affected your life in some way?
In some ways, it has. First, I'd like to point out that when we talk about 6 months to review the transgender ban, that is half as long as has already been spent studying open transgender service. When the last Secretary of Defense decided that he wanted to consider open transgender service, he commissioned a board which studied the issue for a year. He then commissioned the RAND Corporation to do an independent survey, and the New England Journal of Medicine did their own independent survey, while again talking to the 18 partner nations. Open transgender service is the most studied group of people that's ever been allowed to serve in the military. So to allow 6 months to determine how best to deal with transgender people is, I guess, ironic when you consider how thoroughly we've already been looked at.
And you were saying the president's order has already affected you personally?
Yes. So I was scheduled to undergo a gender reassignment surgery, and when this order came down, that surgery was canceled.
Why?
You know, I can't speak to policy. What I know is that I was told through my military leadership and our medical providers that at this point all medical procedures are on hold pending the results of this.
Could you get this surgery on your own? I don't know whether you can afford it, but you could have it if you wanted it?
Yep. So it, at this point, what I'm being told is, yes, transgender service members are still authorized to do things like this, but it will have to come out of their own pocket. And procedures like this, you know, can be somewhat costly to the individual. The irony in it is that the Affordable Care Act makes many of these procedures available to Americans who have health insurance. So we're talking about a procedure that now the only people who are not able to receive it are those who are defending our freedom.
And we should make it clear that not all, I don't know what percentage of transgender people you could get a hormone therapy, you could get gender replacement surgery. My understanding is that's certainly not all, is maybe not even most transgender military service members opt for that.
You know what? Treatment for gender dysphoria can be as individualized as the person who is being treated. Some will opt to have various procedures, and others will feel that minimal things like just hormone treatment help them. It just varies per person. I will tell you that for me, I was fortunate that here in the military, right here at JBLM, in December, I decided that I wanted to have a procedure on my vocal cords. A military doctor decided to perform the first military version of that surgery. It was no cost to the taxpayer because it was done here at the military base, and I had it right before Christmas leave. So while I couldn't speak over Christmas, there was no effect on my readiness, and I came back to work ready to go.
Yeah, there's an example of the range of care that we're talking about here. Again, I'm talking with Army Staff Sergeant Patricia King, who is serving at Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Pierce County. You've been in the Army 18 years, Sergeant. What was it like for you before openly trans people were allowed to serve? That's been most of your time in the military.
Yes, I spent 16 years in the military, as well as many years before that, dealing quietly and privately with the way I felt about my gender incongruence. It was something that was always there in the back of my mind, but I managed to put it off and put it off, and then I reached a point in my life where I decided now is the right time for me to deal with this issue and go ahead and transition. And it was it's a deeply personal decision for anybody who has to go through that. Some will choose to at a younger age for various reasons, and I look forward to a time when people don't have to worry about external factors like discrimination when they make these decisions.
What changed for you personally when the Obama administration reversed that transgender policy?
Well, so I made a decision to come out and start my transition prior to the Secretary of Defense's announcement to reverse the policy. That was actually the Secretary of Defense who had made that decision. I had made a decision after my last deployment. I did some praying and some soul searching, and ultimately decided that it was the right time for me to live an authentic life.
How do you think your bosses feel about your gender status? Can you tell?
Well, I will tell you what they tell me, and what they tell me is that they are proud of me, that they consider this another example of the bravery that we as service members show, and that they support me as a soldier and as a person. For the most part, my gender identity hasn't been an issue. For the last year, while open transgender service was a thing, my gender identity wasn't something we discussed. There was simply no need to. I simply came to work and did my job. It hasn't been something that we've had to deal with until this ban was reinstated.
You talked, Sergeant, about just coming to work and doing your job like anybody else. And as I said, I'm a civilian. Is there any reason for service members to keep their identities to themselves for purposes of cohesion and unity? Is it just like any other job in that sense?
Well, I believe that who you are doesn't affect the job that you do. My peers, my coworkers, the people who know me best, the people who have served in Afghanistan with me, when I came out after my deployment, what they told me was, I know you, I know how capable you are of doing your job, and who you are doesn't affect that to me, doesn't affect the way I see you. I was met with support. I don't think that you wouldn't ask a female, a cisgender female, to act like a man to help with unit cohesion. You wouldn't tell a person of a particular faith to act as though they were of a different faith telling a transgender person that they should hide their gender identity, because all you're doing is suggesting that I shouldn't live an authentic life. And that, if anything, will interfere with our unit cohesion because it puts a barrier up to who I am.
Do you think that President Trump's new transgender ban might push some service members back into the closet, so to speak?
I fear that this situation will do that. I'm afraid that people who wanted to live an authentic life, who wanted to be genuine to themselves and wanted to serve with the same dignity in themselves that they have in their service, will now be afraid that they're unable to do so. And that's the last thing you want to do, is because we want the best and brightest, and the best and brightest come to work with nothing in the way except the job that they have to do.
Could some privately transgender service members do the opposite and come forward now before this ban takes effect?
You know, I can't speak to policy and whether or not that's something that is allowed. What I know is that there are support networks out there. We have a support network called SPARTA, which has over 700 members, all active duty transgender service members who are serving right now and are happy to be there as a support network for people who are going through these things.
Well, what does this still in process military transgender ban? You talked about your gender reassignment surgery is not happening, but there are all these questions about how Defense Secretary Mattis is going to implement this. So, what else do you know this means for you? You're someone who's already in the military, 18 years, Bronze Star recipient.
There are more unknowns for me right now than there are knowns. I don't know if I will be able to retire. I don't know if I will be able to continue to serve, which this is a job that I love. I have no interest in going anywhere. I don't know how my health care will be affected. There are so many things that I don't know. What I do know is that until they tell me that I'm no longer welcome here, I have a job to do and I have people that count on me.
Is there something that's happened to you or a conversation you've had that really stands out to you regarding President Trump's attitude and still to be determined policy towards transgender service members? I just wonder what it's been like to be you, something you've seen, you've heard, you've experienced.
Well, for me personally, being openly transgender and having come out before the ban was lifted, I know that living an authentic life and being true to myself is absolutely the most important thing to me and makes me a better soldier. What I've seen that's really stuck with me is I've had people reach out to me and say, I was almost ready to come out. I had just spoken with my family and I was ready to make that next step and then this happened. What do I do now? Do I stay in the military? Do I come out? These are choices that people are having to face that I just don't know that that's something that they should have to deal with, because it gets in the way of them being able to serve more than transitioning ever could.
How do you answer someone who asks you, what do I do now?
Well, I first tell them that they have to be aware of the consequences that any action that they ever take could make. When you make a decision to come out as a transgender person, you have to be feasibly ready to lose anything that you hold dear, because you simply don't always know how a family member might take it, how a friend might take it. In 42 states in our country, you can be fired simply for being transgender, and now potentially in the military as well. So you have to be understanding of that and come to a point where you decide that living your truth is worth the risk. And I can tell you as a person that lives an authentic life that it absolutely is worth the risk. But you have to be aware of what you're endeavoring upon.
You have to be ready to lose it all. That is Staff Sergeant Patricia King, the first U.S. infantryman to reveal that she's transgender. She's been serving in the Army for 18 years. She's stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. Two federal lawsuits were filed yesterday against President Trump's transgender ban. One of those filed in Seattle on behalf of someone who wants to join the military and also a JBLM soldier who's already serving. Staff Sergeant Patricia King, thanks for telling us your story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on KUOW's The Record, a public radio host was covering the Berkeley demonstrations as a journalist, Then he saw a demonstrator being beaten and kicked by an anti-fascist group, and he had to decide quickly what to do next. You're going to meet him in about 10 minutes. I hope you can stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Free college tuition. Bernie Sanders talked about it. Now it's an issue in the Seattle mayor's race. Reporter David Hyde with KUOW's politics team is here to tell you about it. Hey, David.
Hi, Bill.
So one of the two candidates for Seattle mayor came out yesterday with this proposal, free tuition. What exactly is former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin proposing?
Yeah, this is free tuition. This is a plan for Seattle high school graduates.
As we get ready to go back to school, I want every kid to know that if they do their part, we promise we'll do our part and make sure that 2 years of tuition in Seattle community colleges will be covered for them.
So currently, two Seattle community colleges actually offer some tuition assistance for some students. And Durkin wants to expand those programs to serve around 1,500 students a year. 2 years of tuition, this would be at a public, community, or technical college in the state. And Durkin's plan would also cover all additional fees like books and computers and that kind of thing.
Is there a model for this, David? Another big city with free tuition?
Yeah, there's a lot of places around the country that are trying this. Oakland, California, Kalamazoo.
Kalamazoo,
yes. The Kalamazoo Promise covers 100% of tuition for all of their graduates to any college in the state of Michigan, although that one is privately funded.
Privately funded. Okay, this is important. Who would pay for Jenny Durkin's tuition guarantee?
It's a little bit unclear, but she's saying there's enough money in the current budget to cover it. She's estimating it would cost $4 million the first year, $7 million a year after that. And she's pointing to sources like the Families and Education Levy as possible places where she could find funding for it.
And what is Durkin's opponent, Carrie Moon, saying about this?
Moon's saying she wants to expand education funding too, but here's the big difference. She wants to raise additional revenue to pay for it, and she's talking about new taxes, new tax proposals, I should say, like a capital gains tax or a luxury real estate tax.
Okay, so the candidates have a little different proposals, and that's important. These are candidates in a political campaign. What are the politics behind all of this?
Well, we don't know for sure, right, because they're not talking about their strategy. They're coming out with their proposals. But we do know that candidate Jenny Durkin is being branded the establishment candidate. Mayor McGinn was in last week endorsing her opponent, Carrie Moon, and calling Durkin the establishment candidate. Mm-hmm. So Durkin may feel like she needs to shake that image. And here it comes, free tuition. This is something that Bernie Sanders is talking about. That's now an establishment proposal here in Seattle.
And how do the politics look from Carrie Moon's side?
Her response seems to be, if you pivot left, I'm pivoting further left. So Durkin says we can pay for this out of existing city funds. We've got a $5 billion budget. Moon says, wait a minute, that's going to hurt the very families that we're trying to help. She says we need to raise new tax revenues to help pay for this.
Right. We'll see where these proposals go. That is KUOW's politics reporter David Hyde filling you in on free tuition and on city politics. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Bill.
Now let's talk about another important element of life in a changing Seattle. The Central District used to be the largest black enclave in the Pacific Northwest. That is no more. This Central District resident, architect Donald King, sees the writing on the wall.
Our old sense of a black community will be gone in the next 20 years.
Can the Central District hold on to a sense of black history and community? KUOW's Region of Boom producer Posey Gruner went on two different walking tours covering the same few blocks of the Central District. Those two walking tours approached that history and community question in different ways.
The first tour was put on by The Urbanist, an organization focused on urban policy. A group of about 30 met near the corner of 23rd and Jackson.
I'm just curious, is anybody here from the central area, or are you all from scattered parts around the town?
The tour discussed ways that buildings can reflect and support their community. That could be as simple as a plaque on the wall, or as complicated as an ownership structure. The second tour was put on by Tabernacle Missionary Baptist Church, which has been in the Central District for more than 60 years. Tour members walked the neighborhood in neon green vests, saying hello and inviting people to a barbecue. One tour member, Daniel Ellis, stopped to chat.
Well, basically, we're just walking and in the community in which we live. And noticing the change that, you know, a lot of people are moving in and a lot of people are being probably forced out.
For a brief moment, around 11 a.m., the two tours collided. architect Donald King was talking about the building that will go up where the Red Apple Market is now. Vulcan, Paul Allen's real estate company, met repeatedly with the community as the project was being designed.
It set a standard for the community and feeling empowered that they could make a difference in what they saw going up around them. And sort of understanding that you can't stop this development, but how can you shape it in a way that is more community friendly?
Yolanda McGee, a drop-in from the church tour, listened for a moment, then walked away.
I didn't know if there was for or against what's happening here. Basically, this is all displacement, the way I see it.
As for community building, McGee says she prefers doing that face-to-face. She mentions the church barbecue and that anyone is welcome.
Just come and see us, you know, so we can shake hands and meet a friend. That's the way I see it. But is that really going to happen? I don't see it happening. So this is all talk to me. What they're doing is all just talk.
King, the architect, disagrees.
As an architect, I have a different view of the world. And I believe that there is a place where the physical structure itself and the planning and urban design of the neighborhood can facilitate community.
He points out that the barbecue is happening at a church, which is a building.
So we're not able to do everything. But the part that planners and architects can do is to be able to encourage that and facilitate the gathering space that they're doing that socialization.
The urbanist tour wraps up around 1 p.m. Meanwhile, at 28th and Jackson, the Tabernacle Barbecue is in full swing.
Okay. Not much. What's going on with you?
Same old suit.
Daniel Ellis is at the Domino's table.
Thank you.
That's the game.
Thank you.
You got 50.
But he doesn't last long.
Well, the two players with the lowest score have to get up for others to come in and play. And so I was one of those who were gracious enough to give the next person a chance.
Daniel says he did notice one big change when he was out walking. The church where he found God has become an apartment building. It makes him sad to think that history is gone.
Yeah, a lot of people just take advantage of what has already been built with no regard or respect for what it took to establish what they're trying to take advantage of. And I think that we miss out a lot when we do that, because if we don't know what our history was, how will we be able to build on it?
As for how to know that history and how to build on it, both tours agree that getting out in the neighborhood and meeting your neighbors is a pretty good way to start. In Seattle Central District, I'm Posey Gruner, KUOW News.
The CD is certainly not the only changing neighborhood in Seattle. Surely you have seen how South Lake Union has transformed since Amazon moved in. The Seattle Times reported recently that Amazon has turned Seattle into America's biggest company town. We were discussing the pros and cons of that yesterday on this show, and you had a lot to say. Alan writes, pay hasn't gone up for most of us with the cost of living. Amazon is turning this town into haves and have-nots. On KUOW's Facebook page, Kristen says, the presence of Amazon has priced my husband and me out of our home. Over 50% of our income now goes toward housing. The old Seattle is gone, and the city is unrecognizable. But Jacqueline has a different take. She writes, Amazon is far from the first large company to change our development and housing. My grandpa loves to talk about how Redmond was a nice little town to work in until Microsoft came in. The question I keep circling back to, says Jacqueline, is how do we accommodate growth while respecting our roots? I'd love for it to be as simple as pointing a finger at Amazon and saying, this is the problem. But at the same time, I have an Amazon Prime account. At some point, I'll probably pop into Whole Foods instead of PCC because it's convenient. And I am sure the 2 a.m. orders I place for random household items will persist. And finally, Dale has a suggestion. We need to encourage Amazon to open some satellite campuses, maybe Olympia or Bellingham. It would remove pressure on King County and enable workers in these satellites to actually buy a house. We'd love to hear what you think about this question. Whether Seattle is a company town because of Amazon, pros, cons, what's your experience? You can join the conversation on KUOW's Facebook page or by emailing us record@kuow.org. On Sunday in Berkeley, California, the alt-right group Patriot Prayer from Washington State started a march. counter-protesters showed up. And at one point, a group of anti-fascist or Antifa protesters started beating a man. Someone protected the man who was being beaten. Al Letson jumped on top of the man and yelled, "Stop!" Letson is a public radio host. His show is called Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX. Al, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Who was that man you protected?
I actually don't know.
You still don't know?
No. I mean, there are people. There's someone on Twitter who says they're him, but I there's so much misinformation going on. I don't know. Like, maybe it is him. Maybe it's not. I don't know.
Will you tell us the story? What did you see?
I saw a gentleman, Joey Gibson, who was trying to do the Patriot Prayer in San Francisco on Saturday.
By the way, our listeners will know him because he organized the Patriot Prayer just recently here in downtown Seattle.
Okay, so he was doing that in San Francisco, but it didn't happen. And so on Sunday, he came to Berkeley, which, you know, your listeners should know that primarily the protest was pretty peaceful. There was a couple times when some tempers got heated and maybe like a skirmish broke out here and there, but it wasn't like this was a big riot or anything like that. It was just, you know, some isolated incidences. Anyway, Joey came to the park and he began antagonizing members of the Black Bloc. And the Black Bloc, it's a part of Antifa, but, you know, nuance here, most of the people at this protest, I don't think you could categorize them as Antifa. They were just people protesting against white supremacy, against Donald Trump, against, you know, where this country is heading. So that was majority of the people there. I'd say, you know, just guessing 70% of those people were like that. There was a small group who were, you know, Antifa and Black Bloc. And so the Black Bloc, Joey went directly to them, antagonized them. He never punched them or anything, but, you know, he was throwing his hands up like he wanted to fight and saying stuff. And then the people on the other side of the little plastic barrier began to come over the barrier and chase Joey. Now, I was right next to him when this is happening. I filmed it all. Joey ran away from them, crossed the street, found the police, and got behind a police line. And so I was there. I captured all that. I turned to my left and I saw this guy on the ground and four or five people were around him and they were kicking him. And I saw someone take a flagpole and kind of beat him with it. When I saw that happen, and I was worried, but then I looked behind them and there was like a whole crowd of people, at least 20 or 30 people heading towards him. And in that moment, I thought that the guy was going to die. And I thought if they all teamed up on him, it was over.
Did you think about whether this guy on the ground was a good guy or a bad guy?
No, it didn't matter. I mean, he was a human being. That's all I saw. I saw a human on the ground who needed some help. You know, I didn't want to get involved in it as far as, like, I wasn't going to fight anybody. But I felt like, you know, I had to help the guy. So originally I was going to try to break it up, but I realized I couldn't break it up. There were too many of them. So I just put my body on top of them to block it because I didn't want him to get hurt.
Were you scared?
I was petrified. I saw the guy on the ground and yeah, I was scared. And when I got on top of him, at first I was scared for him. I thought, oh my God, they're going to kill him. And then I got over to him and, you know, tried to protect him as best I could. And when the blows started coming on me, which wasn't a lot, but like I got hit once or twice, I thought, oh my God, they're going to kill me. So I was scared. And then afterwards, I don't even know how it dissipated. I just know it did. And I was dazed by it all.
When you say Joey Gibson was antagonizing these counter-protesters, what do you mean? What was he doing?
So Joey, I was on the same side of the green with Joey, and Joey came walking up across the street. It's a four-lane street, a big street here in Berkeley called MLK. And so he crossed MLK, walked onto the grass in the park and walked right up to the little plastic barricades where most of the black bloc was standing sort of in formation. And he threw his hands out and he was saying stuff to them. You know, I'm not sure what exactly he was saying, but he was just taunting them. And he was getting really close to them. He was not touching anybody, but he was definitely like putting his arms out and waving at them like, come get me, come get me. You know, and he had his friend Tiny with him, and Tiny was behind him, and Tiny was egging him on as well. And then people on the other side started throwing things at them. They were throwing anything they could get their hands on. I saw people throw fruit at them, to plastic water bottles, to a flagpole. And then finally, after, you know, all of this antagonization, you know, that was started by Joey, the rest of the black bloc jumped over the little barricades and started chasing Joey. And it wasn't like, you know, they were chasing him like they were at a full run. It was more like Joey was kind of jogging backwards while they were coming, and he was talking smack, and this other guy was, you know, screaming at him to get away. And yeah, so it just amplified from there.
That's interesting, because I've interviewed Joey Gibson. I've seen, I wasn't at the rally in downtown Seattle, but I saw his speech, and I've heard him talk so much about how this is just about free speech. And he's not trying to antagonize, or he's not trying to provoke a confrontation. And you're giving a different sounding account than how Joey Gibson wants to present himself when I know of him in Seattle.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that what I saw of him yesterday, I don't know what happened in Seattle, but I can tell you what I saw yesterday, he was absolutely antagonizing them.
I ask because I guess some people are wondering whether the most violent of the reactors are playing into Joey Gibson's hands.
Yeah, well, I think that is part of the problem. That what happens is that when you have the Antifa or protesters or whoever they are striking back against the alt-right, white supremacists, so forth and so on, there's a false equivalency that's made when people see that violence on the screen or hear it on the radio. The false equivalency is that the two sides are equal and they're just as bad. And that's not true. One side wants to get rid of all people that aren't white in this country and create an ethnostate. And the other side are trying to stand up and protect the quote-unquote minorities, the LGBTQ community, the black community, the Hispanic community. Like, so I feel like a group that wants to annihilate and get rid of people versus a group that's trying to stand up and fight for those people, there's no equivalency in those two things. But I definitely think that violence that comes from the left makes that equivalency more possible, right? It's not factual, but it's what people see and what they go away with, and also what hard right provocateurs use to make their point, to galvanize people and get them on their side.
I've seen some progressive Twitter commenters saying, we won because the counter-protesters far outnumbered the right-wingers in Berkeley. What do you think of that that assessment that Berkeley on Sunday was a success for the left?
I don't know. I don't think it actually was, because I think that the right has now been armed with these videos of, you know, these sporadic moments of violence that they can paint to certain parts of the country and say, look at this big riot that happened here, and it was these, you know, anti-Trump people who did it. So I don't think necessarily that they actually won. But on the flip side, I would say that many people on the right felt that Charlottesville was a win for them, and I think it was absolutely not a win for them. So we're in these hard times, and I guess I'm even uncomfortable with what I just said, saying wins and losses, because wins and losses makes what's going on in this country sound like it's sports. So much of the commentary that I see on cable news feels like I'm watching a sports show, you know, with anchors going at each other with their different teams or whatever. And this isn't sports. Like, this is people's lives. You know, this is the fate of our country. So wins and losses is a tricky thing to kind of wrap your head around when you're talking about people's lives.
We've been having so much discussion about how to respond to white nationalist protesters. Did you see Tina Fey's bit on Saturday Night Live?
I didn't. I heard a lot about it, but I didn't see it.
Well, she was saying, you know, joking around about don't even give these protesters, the alt-right, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, don't give them any attention. Just stay home and eat cake. We've all probably seen that white nationalist Richard Spencer getting punched. And we have President Trump saying, look, there's people swinging clubs on both sides. What's your take on the right way to respond to white supremacists?
That's a good question. I don't know if being in the position of a journalist, if giving my take is the right way to go with it. I would just say that I think that we all have to. I think that this country is in a really precarious situation right now. You know, I'm 45 years old, and I think that I've never seen the country in the place that it's in right now. And being that, you know, prior to working for Reveal, I had my own show, State of the Reunion, which you guys played. Thank you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I travel the country, so I know the country pretty well, probably more than a lot of people do. And I've never seen us this divided or fractured before, and it's really a scary time. And I think that we all have to think about what it means for us individually and how we can figure out how to bring it all back together. I don't want to give anybody any answers about what they should or shouldn't do. All I can say is that for me, in that moment, it didn't matter whether the guy on the ground was a white supremacist and he, you know, doesn't see my humanity. Like it's my humanity isn't dependent upon him seeing mine. My humanity is dependent upon me seeing his. And so in looking at him in that place, you know, it felt like I didn't have a choice. Like this is, you know, you can't just talk about it. You got to be about it. I can't suggest that anybody else take those type of actions. I can just tell you that's what my compass told me to do. And I did it.
Will you say more about that precarious situation that the United States seems to be in? What do you make of it?
Yeah, well, I think that where we are right now is we have a country that's breaking apart along fault lines that have been in the United States since the beginning. You know, America was based on the concept of white supremacy. I know that makes people uncomfortable sometimes when you say it, but when you really think about it, you know, black people were brought over here to be slaves because they were less than the white people that were owning them. And Native Americans were pushed off their land because they were looked at as less than the white people that wanted those lands. And so it's a clear vision of what white supremacy looks like and how it plays out. And we may not call it that because we have a lot of love for our founding fathers, but that's at the building blocks of this country. And that building block has fractures in it. There's a tension between the high ideals that this country is supposed to live up to and the actuality of what this country is. And so those fault lines were always going to get bigger. They were always going to get exploited. It's just that now time seems to have ramped up that erosion and here we are. So that's what I mean when I say that we're in a precarious situation. We're in this tough spot where in order to fix those big cracks, we have to get honest and really deal with some stuff. But America's not good at doing that stuff. America's good at passing the buck and keep moving on. We have these big explosions of race in America every 5 to 6 years, whether it's Trayvon Martin, whether it's O.J. Simpson, whether it's the L.A. riots and Rodney King. Like, race continues to pop up, you know, whether we have a president that's talking about building a wall and calling Mexicans, saying the criminals and rapists and all sorts of stuff. Like, those cracks have always been there and they were always going to be where they are. But because of the path that we've been on in this country for the last, you know, God knows how long, it seems to have accelerated it. And so that's what I mean. Like, we're in a tough spot right now.
We're in a tough spot. That is Al Letson, host of the public radio show Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. He and his team have made a special episode about Sunday's protests in Berkeley. We are tweeting that out right now at KUOW. So you just heard Al Letson say that this country's in a precarious position with a serious faction of Americans wanting a white ethno state. I'm sure you've heard the comparisons to Nazi Germany. Well, my next guest has studied that comparison. Lori Marhofer is an assistant professor of history at the University of Washington. She's writing a book comparing and contrasting the rise of Nazis in Germany with the rise of neo-Nazis in America today. Welcome, Professor.
Hey, thanks for having me.
First of all, Al Letson said that he sees this country as frighteningly divided. He says it's a precarious time. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm also losing sleep at night over the state of the country. And I don't want to overstate the comparison to 1933 in Germany. There are tremendous differences between our situation and their situation. At the same time, what we have seen in this country is the rise of a right-of-center populist movement that succeeded in seizing or in winning the White House in a general election. This is a movement that uses white racism. It's a movement that has authoritarian leanings, and it has succeeded in taking power in a democratic context where we have a relatively free civil society. And that is in many ways similar to what Germans were facing in late 1932, early 1933. Of course, there are also tremendous differences. So Trump's ideology is really vastly different from that of the Nazis. Trump is not a fascist. Almost no one who studies German fascism would identify Trump as a fascist.
Could you briefly say more about that, why Trump is not a fascist?
Yeah, sure. So fascism has a couple of core components that Trumpism lacks. One is that fascism was a deep and powerful rejection of liberal individualism. And I think you can see this the best in fascist film and fascist visual propaganda. So if you look at a movie like Triumph of the Will, which is a 1934 documentary of a Nazi party rally, there are lots of scenes of hundreds of people standing in formation, all dressed in uniforms and moving together. And the camera loves to focus on one person's face and then to pull back to show you this really powerful shot of so many people all together in this great mass. So that is the fascist ideal of the total subordination of the individual to the collective. And in the case of German fascism, it's a racial collective, right? The folk, the historical people defined by race and blood. And fascism demands that you give up every form of individual right in the service of that. So you no longer...
You don't see that kind of unity at a Trump rally.
Oh, I certainly don't. I do see it in the alt-right, however. Some of the people who went to Charlottesville and who were there in Berkeley have views that are somewhat like that. But I just don't think Trump does. And he's certainly not expressing them openly. I think people are right that Trumpism is a form of neoliberalism. It's not fascism, but it's also a right of center populist movement that has authoritarian leanings, and that really alarms me.
Is there a parallel in that the Nazis were portraying themselves as fighting against a violent left?
Yeah.
And sometimes you hear that from the alt-right movement, right? There's the equivalence we talked about on many sides. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so I feel I have an obligation right now as somebody who studies German history to talk about that, because I think that is an important parallel. One of the key steps in the building of the Nazi dictatorship was that the Nazis fomented violence in the streets by provoking leftists, got into street fights with them, let those street fights be portrayed in the media, and then turned around and portrayed themselves as victims of left-wing violence and claimed that they needed emergency police powers to put down the violence left. And they were
successful. Restore law and order?
Exactly, and restore law and order. So the Reichstag fire decree was simply Hitler saying, we need to put down the communists and we need to suspend the Constitution to do that. And I'm very concerned that the neo-Nazis and white supremacists who see Trump as an ally are provoking leftist violence right now. And then we've seen Trump claim that there's leftist violence is also a big problem. We have seen him talk about the need for police to be rougher. We just saw him pardon the former sheriff, Joe Arpaio, who had abused his power as a police officer, had violated the constitutional rights of people based on racial profiling, and Trump pardoned him. So we have somebody in the executive branch who is actively moving towards police power. And I just think it's a very dangerous moment.
Do you think the rallies in Charlottesville, Virginia, the Patriot Prayer Rally in Seattle and Berkeley. Do you think those were designed to provoke lefty opponents into overreacting?
I think they were
those are all relatively liberal cities. Even yeah. Charlottesville's a college town there too.
Yeah. So what the Nazis did was to organize rallies and marches in communist neighborhoods on purpose, and we have documents from the Nazi Party that show that they did this on purpose to provoke the communists to violence. And I do think that the people who organized the rallies that we've seen recently in Charlottesville, the recent Berkeley rally, did that on purpose to provoke especially the Antifa to violence. And I'm very, very worried about what could happen on the national level about that, about the way that violence is perceived, and then how people who are friendly towards authoritarianism could make use of that perception.
Well, then let's talk about this question of how to respond. I mentioned people who oppose the so-called alt-right are debating. I talked about Saturday Night Live, Tina Fey saying, don't give them the very attention that they want.
I really want to say, to encourage all good, sane Americans to treat these rallies this weekend like the opening of a thoughtful movie with two female leads. Don't show up. Let these morons scream into the empty air.
Then other people are saying, no, if you ignore white supremacists, you're effectively saying, oh, they're not that bad. And on our Facebook page, Chase wants direct action, writes, private citizens should kick them out of the public square. Literally, every white supremacist is just three bags of trash in a person suit and deserves no courtesy. You have studied the question of what leads to what. What do you think about this question?
Yeah, okay, so Tina Fey is wrong. It's not a good idea to ignore Nazis and white supremacists, and nothing shows that more powerfully than the example of Germany in the 1930s. It is absolutely imperative that people who oppose racism and Nazism go out on the streets and peacefully demonstrate in large numbers. I think the demonstrations that we have seen so far in this country have been really important in putting the brakes on Trumpism. And I think that it's imperative to respond to Nazism and white supremacy by protesting. But I also
by a mocking protest, by a silent vigil. Do you have any observations about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really bad idea to allow the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists to provoke you to violence. And I think that the left needs to remember that any accusations of chaos in the streets or violence rebound against the left. They don't stick very well against the right. And we are seeing this now, even when the violence is on the side of the right. And that was the case in Germany as well. When it gets into the mainstream press, a lot of people who are right of center just think it's the left's fault no matter what. And that has to do with the legacy of white racism in this country. It has to do with the legacy of law and order rhetoric. But it's imperative, especially for the left, to avoid even the hint of physical confrontation.
I have seen derision. I've seen mocking. I've seen some funny signs. I've seen costumes. I've also seen people just silently, solemnly, holding hands or holding candles. What do you think is most effective?
Gosh, well, the Southern Poverty Law Center has recommended that you hold a large, peaceful rally well away from the neo-Nazis and white supremacists if they come to your town, and you put a lot of physical space in between you and them so that they cannot attack you and they can't provoke you to defend yourself. In Germany, clowning has been used pretty effectively. I think there's a number of ways to respond, but I think it's really, really important not to be provoked to violence. And violence as a strategy, I mean, I think is terrible, particularly in this moment when it's so crucial that we defend our democratic institutions.
What about on an interpersonal level? I suppose this could happen at a downtown rally, but on our Facebook page, Kelson suggests listening to them, quote, you don't need to agree with them or entertain their ideas to listen. And people will only change their views if they feel like they are being listened to. Does experience show that listening actually works?
Gosh, well, studies have shown that people are drawn to neo-Nazism and white supremacy because they feel victimized. And I think, and because they feel shut down. And I think that making a space for them to rethink their ideas can, in some contexts, be helpful and beneficial. You know, at the same...
Any personal experience with it?
So at UW, it is our great privilege to serve the students of the state of Washington and elsewhere. And we do have students on campus who are part of the alt-right. And we have struggled with that. And I have struggled with that. And I got to tell you, when I found out that in my course on Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, there were alt-right students who believed in a white ethno-state and who probably sympathized with Holocaust denial, the first thing I wanted to do was...
They were in your class?
Yeah, they were taking my class. There are students. We have lots of different students from lots of different backgrounds, and they are there. I wanted them out of the class, and I didn't want to teach the class if they were in it. And I struggled with that. And I think that's kind of like what Chase was talking about on Facebook, that we're not going to let them make these statements. We're not going to let them come to our town. We just deny it. These ideas are violent, and we're going to say no to them. But of course, I can't do that as a professor. I can't kick them out of class for their views. I can't stop teaching. And over the course of many conversations with different people, including with some of these students, I came to see that probably my class on Nazi Germany and the Holocaust was absolutely the best place for these people to be if they were doing the reading, and some of them were. And I think that it's possible that they rethought some of what they think. So I do think that there's a place for that. But what I would say to the Antifa and to people who are organizing demos right now is don't fall into their trap. Don't let them make these YouTube videos of white supremacists and neo-Nazis getting beaten up, because that is exactly what happened in Germany when the Weimar Republic fell. And it was a big part of why democracy failed in Germany. That is really what I want to emphasize. I don't have all the answers, but I do have that.
Again, we're talking with Assistant Professor of History at the University of Washington, Lori Marhofer, who's writing a book comparing and contrasting the rise of Nazis in Germany with the rise of neo-Nazis in America today. And that's about our time. Was there a story of a student reading up on the Holocaust and changing his or her mind? Did that happen in your class?
I can't talk specifically about my students, right? Because of privacy laws and because of my obligations to them. But I think that there are people who are drawn to the alt-right who are able to think critically and who can possibly move away from it. And I think that sometimes it's really good for them to be in a classroom.
Assistant Professor of History Lori Marhofer also has a book, Sex and the Weimar Republic, German Homosexual Emancipation and the Rise of the Nazis. And it's been really fascinating and helpful for you to come in and talk about what you're seeing today in America. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in today, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.